Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books and Gender Studies. I am the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today my conversation is with Amy Orison, Associate Professor of Journalism and Media Studies at Fordham University and former editor at Working Woman and Ms. Magazines. We will discuss her most recent biography, Crystal Eastman, A Revolutionary Life, published by Oxford University Press. Eastman was a women's rights activist, labor lawyer, radical feminist, writer, and co-founder of what became the Civil Liberties Union. Her life was shaped by key relationships, including with her mother, Anise Ford Eastman, and a close relationship with her brother, Max Eastman, editor of the socialist magazine, The Masses. Subsequently, with her brother, they would launch The Liberator. Eastman spoke and wrote about a variety of social and political problems and was threatened by censorship and economic hardship. One of her chief concerns was how women could combine meaningful work with family based on egalitarian ideals of independence and freedom. She attempted to live out her feminist ideals by redefining her marriage, motherhood, and career. Crystal Eastman offers a vivid portrait of a modern feminist navigating the hazards of private and public life as it unfolded in the progressive era. Here is my conversation with Amy Orison.
Let me introduce you to the author, Amy Orison. Hello, Amy.
Hi, how you doing?
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience.
First, thank you.
Before we get into the book, I want to know a little bit about you and your background and how you came to write Crystal Eastman, A Revolutionary Life.
Well, actually, I have been working on this book and to one degree or other for over 20 years now. The first time I came in contact with Crystal Eastman was when I was doing the research for my dissertation proposal in graduate school. And I bumped into a few of her essays about feminism. And they really, really reached me. They really seemed so contemporary. I loved her candor. I related to her point of view. I thought her ideas were just incredible. Incredibly relevant and refreshing. But I didn't end up writing my dissertation on a historical period that would allow me to actually incorporate her into that work. So I went on, I wrote my dissertation, I completed my degree. I then took some time away from academia. I worked as a magazine editor for a number of years, and then I returned to academia in 2006, partly because I knew that it would give me the chance to actually return to the work on Crystal Eastman, to actually return to her. Over all of those years and those, you know, the kind of different twists and turns in my professional life, I just never forgot her. You know, I feel today like she didn't let me go. There was some way in which she was just this voice kind of calling ahead of herself into the era in which I lived and into the questions that I had as a feminist, particularly as a feminist. And so when I got the chance, I dived into the research and the result some years later is this book.
Now, let's talk about, now get to Eastman, her family. Let's talk about her family of origin. What was their place in American society generally? You know, what are their roots?
Their roots were Crystal grew up in upstate New York, in Elmira, for most of her life. You know, she sort of hails from Elmira, New York, in the kind of northern tier. But she was the daughter of two congregational ministers, and much of her early life was quite itinerant. Her father moved from parish to parish, and ultimately they only gained stability when, after her father had, you know, suffered some illness, her mother actually was ordained. Annis Ford Eastman was her mother's name, and she was the first woman ordained as a congregational minister in the state of New York. And she became really the breadwinner of the family. She became the co-pastor at the Park Church in Elmira. That's how they ended up there. Quite a well-known, very sort of abolitionist, progressive congregation. So they lived in a very vibrant intellectual, moral, and political community, but they were not particularly well off. In fact, they were not well off at all. A lot of Crystal's early letters are about saving money and recycling clothing and, you know, trying to make ends meet. And early on in her career, in fact, the need for a job, the need for work, when she had become a lawyer and had a hard time finding a job in 1908 as a woman lawyer, led her to the path that she ultimately took, because she had to nail down some kind of employment. And she ended up taking the job working for the Pittsburgh Survey and doing other kinds of work outside of the law.
Okay, I want to talk about Annis Ford Eastman, her mother, who looms very large in the narrative. She's very prominent in her life, very prominent, particularly in her early years. She's an unconventional woman, and not only because she's a minister and she's preaching, but she's also has some vanguard ideas. Her mother has some really interesting ideas that she tried to live out that were very different from like the norm. So can you talk a little bit about Annis and her ideas and how she stands out?
Yes. Crystal's relationship with her mother was the most important in her life. And her mother was, you know, a compelling personality in so many ways, politically, as well as interpersonally, socially. Annis Ford Eastman modeled a kind of feminist woman's life that Crystal herself dreamed of living and tried very hard to live in her own life in a very different time. In fact, the last article that Crystal ever wrote in her life begins with the idea that, you know, her own story is her mother's story. She starts that article published in The Nation in 1927, just a few months before Crystal died, with the line, "The story of my life is the story of my mother." Annis did a lot, talked a lot and worked a lot and modeled a lot to have a feminist household. And that meant that chores were shared between Crystal and her brothers more or less equally. There were no, you know, boys' chores and girls' chores, but Crystal too took a turn chopping wood, you know, as well as making beds and preparing meals, as did her brothers also do work inside the household on a rotating schedule. She also pioneered a lot of kind of collectivist ideas to live in a community that would ultimately remove the, you know, overwhelming responsibilities of housekeeping from the shoulders of women. A little bit in Elmira, in their kind of regular life, their day-to-day life, but in the summers particularly, they had a summer cottage upstate on Lake Seneca in Glenora, New York. And they bought property and lived amongst a group of friends, each of whom had their own small cottage, and then they had, you know, collective spaces to eat and gather together. And they shared.
That was really interesting. That was really interesting to me.
Yes, it is really interesting. They shared the tasks of housekeeping and meal preparation during the summer, so that, you know, every family, but, you know, it turned out to be most of the time, every woman had, you know, maybe one or two weeks of housekeeping the entire summer, and they all, you know, collectively ate together, enjoyed the free time together, and were able to pursue pursue other interests of theirs. A lot of this was modeled on some of the early, kind of collectivist Christian traditions, but also Annis Eastman and later Crystal were very close with Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And, you know, it was Gilman who kind of interjected into these broader, you know, Christian collectivist paradigms, the idea of, you know, a feminist angle, whereby, you know, it would be women who would be freed from housekeeping in order to pursue their other interests, in order to pursue other relationships, in order to have freedom to do what they wanted with their time.
Now, her father, Samuel Elijah Eastman, is pretty much a shadow figure in the book and in her life. He doesn't seem to have much influence in the family or in life. Can you talk a little bit about him and what happened to him and his temperament? Was it a temperament thing or something else?
Yeah, Samuel Eastman, her father, is a very, very interesting character. You are so right that he was quite marginal in the household, quite marginal in the family. This is mainly because Annis Eastman wanted that way. Crystal's mother, struggled. Max Eastman recalls that, you know, that Crystal's mother struggled with her sex life. After Max was born, her fourth child, as far as we know, they never shared a bed together again, Crystal's mother and father. She really, you know, kind of pushed him to the margins of the household, the margins of the family unit, was very much the center of the home, and made it a very female-centric, female-centered kind of culture inside their house. Part of that had to do with their interpersonal dynamics, the possibility that, Annis Eastman may have been lesbian. I don't have any direct evidence of any same-sex sexual activity, but, certainly her attitudes about her husband, and her attitudes about sex, as Max recounts them, you know, suggests that may have been a possibility. He also was frail had lost a lung in battle in the Civil War, so he, you know, had a lot of physical ailments, connected to that probably because of the rejection of his wife and the difficulty in struggling to be the kind of husband that she wanted. And to have the kind of wife that he wanted. I think that took an emotional toll on him. Max suggests as much also in his writing. So he had, you know, a series of breakdowns where he went to sanatoriums and recovered and then returned to the family. Still, with all of that, from everybody's memories, everything that I could get a hold of in researching the book, Samuel Eastman was a quiet pillar of strength in his daughter's life. When it came down to it, he stood up for her. He stood up for her feminist ways. Sometimes when her own mother, her beloved mother, was less comfortable with her more, you know, kind of radical actions in the community and her refusal to wear a traditional binding swimming costume, for example, when they were upstate in their summer place. And he stood up for her despite the disapproval of the neighbors. Be able to live as she wanted and enjoy the freedoms that he had, and he recognized that he had in his life.
Now, the thing that was really strange about this family, because Annis, her mother, was such a strong figure. It wasn't just that she was a strong figure in terms of ideas and action. There was a very tight emotional bond between her mother, Crystal Eastman, and then her brother, Max Eastman. There was kind of this triangle going on there.
Yes.
A family. It's almost like it was enmeshment of some sort. I mean, I'm using a modern psychological, analysis of this, but it was a very kind of odd emotional bond. Can you talk about that? Those three together? And of course, the father's kind of outside that triangle. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. They had a very, you're so right, they had a very complex emotional relationship. Crystal, Max, and Annis were this kind of inner triangle, inner core of the family. And that was a grouping that Annis, really created and reinforced. It's very apparent in her letters with both children, both Crystal and Max, the ways that she expected them and wanted them to not only be close to her and stay close to her, but also to stay close to and take care of each other. While Annis was alive, they formed this kind of tight inner core, and everyone else in the family rotated around it. And they were kind of satellites, really. It was not just Crystal's father, Sam, who was in the outskirts of the family, but also her elder brother, Anstis, who later in his life went by the name Ford. His mother's middle name, which is interesting, but he too, had struggled to relate to his mother, struggled to maintain his mother's love, and was often sort of banished to the outskirts of the family. That inner triangle, you used, I think, some modern psychological terms rightly. Max himself, refers to the incest taboo when he talks about his mother and particularly his sister, and how, in his experience of all the, as he says, the kind of plain and fancy notions that Freud had, the incest taboo makes the most sense to him in his own experience. That in many ways, he and his mother and sister were a love triangle. And when their mother passed away in 1911, Max and Crystal, had a lot of kind of charged romantic interactions and a lot of blurring of their different roles to each other. Certainly they were a very, very, very close brother and sister, but they also, there was a lot of romantic and even sexual valence in their letters to each other and in their relationship to each other, as well as a kind of, they would draw closer to each other, and then often something would happen and Max particularly would pull away, but then he would come back and pull away. There was just a lot of tension from, I think, those, kind of romantic sparks that they never really came to terms with, in their emotional lives. But it bonded them and kept them unusually close throughout their lives. They worked together a lot. They lived near each other, as often as they possibly could. When they weren't living together, their letters, reflect how much they missed each other. It was a really a very unusual relationship that not just you and not just me, but others who have written particularly about Max have spent a great deal of time, thinking about and talking about in terms of their romantic attachment between brother and sister, or the romantic aspects of the attachment between brother and sister. And also, some have theorized that part of the reason that Max may have become an apostate and become a right wing figure late in his life. He was a member of the John Birch Society. Had to do with the kind of loss of Crystal and the loss of that sort of North Star that he found in her in so many different ways.
Okay, let's go on to talk about the concept or the idea that you present of mother worship that is appropriate to this scenario. What is the idea of mother worship, and how does Annis fit into this, her mother fit into this?
Well, I mean, Crystal idolized her mother. She did worship her mother. She, she wanted to be like her. She looked up to her incredibly. She had a kind of passionate devotion to her and to her health and stability. Likewise, to a certain extent, Annis also deified her daughter, particularly in kind of an emotional dynamic between them. Annis Eastman was a manic depressive. And she would, she had, many of the characteristics that we, think about today with, sort of manic depressive geniuses. She had these glittering moments of eloquence and inspiration. And then she would, kind of unaccountably, with very little warning, sink into the darkest depths of self-doubt. And you know, through those episodes, it was mainly Crystal who not only stepped in to try to rescue her, to try to kind of pull her back to stability, but who Annis repeatedly said in her letters and in their interactions, you know, she repeatedly said that Crystal was the only one who could do so. You know, that there was something innate to Crystal's being and to their relationship to each other that, you know, gave Crystal a, you know, a particular, you know, talismanic or power to lift Annis out of those dark depths, to rescue her, to save her.
That's a really heavy burden for a child to carry.
Yes, ma'am, it certainly is. And I think that, I write in the first chapter of the book about the ways that I think it sort of established for, you know, Crystal's radical sensibility and many of the best and worst qualities that she had. The best qualities in that she was always an idealist. She was always, as a feminist and as a reformer and as a radical, she would not stop in attempting to make the world a better, finer place. She spoke up, she stood up always, you know, throughout her life. On the other hand, she struggled with some of her interpersonal relationships. And a lot of the book is about the ways that she worked institutionally, working across different movements and with different major, major figures, many of whom were women leaders. And she often struggled with, you know, with boundaries and restraint. She often struggled with the ability to, if there was disagreement, to come to some compromises with them. Instead, you know, she learned from her mother and from the experience of trying to draw her mother out of these depths that if there was a problem, the thing she should do is pour herself more fully, you know, more intensely into that breach. In order to kind of rescue the situation that way. In many cases, I think that was not successful in her relationships. And it made a number of her kind of challenging relationships at times within organizations that much more difficult.
Now, with all this closeness to her mother, she was her generation of women were very different from her mother's generation, and so I want to talk. Let's talk a little bit about the difference that actually caused tension between her mother and herself. You know, one of them was where she was going to go to college. That became a big scene. Can you talk a little bit about her generation of women and the women she associated with, like Florence Kelly and Lillian Wald and Alice Paul, Margaret Sanger, women that she came across with, that she worked with, that she joined in different movements, and how were they different from the previous generation of women that we would call feminist or pro-women women?
Yeah, it's such, all of these women's lives were so fascinating, and the intersections between them, both generationally and politically and in other ways are just that's why there's such a rich literature, you know, in intellectual history and women's history and other areas, on these movements and on these leaders. Crystal knew, everybody. I mean, she really worked across multiple movements and worked with so many major giants and icons of her time. Her generation of sort of modern young women was really the first to cross over into the 20th century, to come of age in the 20th century. And they were, the first generation where a larger number of women were going on to college and were able to step out into the public space, to have careers, many of them sort of public work and community work. And so that separated her generation in many ways from their mothers or from the previous generation. Even some of those who were activist women, who were suffrage leaders, for example, or settlement house leaders as well, women like Wald or Kelly, who were a bit older and came of age with a different set of values and, making a different equation, I guess, between their gender and the way that they used and presented and lived their gender and their public lives. Crystal's generation, you know, at least her friends, you know, her, you know, kind of New York educated activist friends were more outspoken. And we would call them, you know, fierce, right? They were fierce, kind of in your face activists in a way that many of the older, more senior, more experienced women were often, you know, less comfortable with. And so there were a lot of kind of interesting tensions and stories there, not only between, you know, Crystal and some of these elders, but also, you know, many of her, you know, kind of generational cohort, you know, Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, Inez Mulholland, you know, numbers of other activist women who were her close, close friends in that modern generation.
How do you think that she, after she came out of college, she went and worked at the Greenwich House Settlement. She was in a settlement situation. How did these early years, or college years, and right after college, how did those years shape her political views?
I think they shaped both her political views and her kind of social, you know, her social views, her social optimism. Working at Greenwich House Settlement, you know, was part of a, you know, kind of three things were happening when she lived there. One, she was living in the Greenwich House Settlement, downtown Lower Manhattan, you know, in a sort of bohemian, greater setting, but also, you know, in neighborhoods with, like, all the settlement houses, you know, lots of immigrants, lots of poverty, and, you know, living, you know, really with and amongst these communities of people was a, you know, important part of the settlement house movement and an important part of forming Crystal's mentality about social action and her leftist politics. At the same time, she was living at Greenwich House Settlement because she was going to NYU Law School. She was one of a, you know, a kind of relatively early cohort of women who were becoming lawyers. And NYU was at that time a haven for young women who wanted to go to law school. Many other law schools would not accept women at all. You know, at the time, the dean of Columbia Law School, you know, famously said that, you know, kind of expressed over my dead body, basically, you know, women will come here. And so it was really a hotbed of, you know, really smart, activist young women lawyers. And that too, you know, kind of changed her life, changed her outlook. Crystal always wanted to practice law. And the law was more forbidding, had, you know, greater barriers to women's entry than many other of the, you know, kind of educated professions that began opening to women at that time. And she was never able to find a job practicing law. But in all of her, or in many of her social activist roles and many of the movements that which she was involved in, she often relied on the courts and thought about the courts and conceptualized actions in terms of, you know, creating test cases that the organization could then take into the justice system. She was a, you know, a big advocate of that within the forerunner to the ACLU, and that, you know, of course became a real modus operandi for the organization from very early on. So she also had that. And then, you know, around it all was the Greenwich Village kind of bohemian arena. She, in those days, the subway didn't yet reach Greenwich Village. So, there was a street life and a kind of seclusion, a kind of teeming seclusion, if you will. There were, you know, lots of people and lots to think about and lots of activism and activity from all kinds of different people, lots of diversity. At the same time, as there was also a, you know, a kind of community sense and opportunities for social experimentation, romantic, sexual experimentation, political experimentation, conversation, you know, kind of salons and other kind of public meetings, artistic experimentation. And so those three things together, you know, I think opened her up to the sense of, you know, a virtually endless possibility that, you know, often is associated with particularly New York City, but some other parts of the country and around the world in the, you know, kind of early modern era, pre-World War I. And, you know, those kinds of things, she never really let go of that energy and that optimism and that sense of possibility. And all three of those kind of combined and cross-fertilized to you know, create that and reinforce that and bring, you know, embed that really in her heart and in her soul.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, one thing that was I noticed in throughout the book was that she never landed on anything for very long. She was involved in so many things like labor, women's rights, birth control, pacifism, civil liberties. I mean, she every issue of the day she had somehow touched, but she never really like stayed with anything for very long in her writing or in her work. And she always had this kind of precarious economic situation because she's always looking for how can she make, you know, a living pursuing her writing or her activism. So what got in her, and you call her an intersectional thinker. Can you talk about what was getting in her way of actually making a commitment to one thing, like Alice Paul, for instance, or Margaret Sanger? They committed to one particular issue. She just didn't seem to be able to do that.
Yeah, you know that is, I think as I write in the book, that was really a defining characteristic of hers. That Crystal Eastman, I see her as an early intersectional activist, in that she, you know, tried to bridge multiple movements. She tried to and wanted to bring multiple movements together under one really vast emancipatory rubric. And so she, you know, she talked to the members of one movement. She, you know, talked to feminists, for example, about socialism and about internationalism, also about family, about maternalism, things that, you know, other activists didn't necessarily talk about. You know, the things that Alice Paul, for example, who was, you know, kind of very single-minded, you know, that was just to her, those were distractions, you know, that was off the agenda. You know, but when she was in amongst socialists or amongst internationalists, she talked about feminism and, you know, brought these other dimensions to those movements. And so she was always trying to build bridges and, you know, create linkages amongst all these leftist movements. And you know, that's part of the reason why she moved from one movement to the next, was that she could see those connections. And, you know, other circumstances, of course, collaborated to help her, you know, to help her, to encourage her, I suppose, to move from one to the next. You know, historical events, things changed in the movements and in the country and in the world. But she could see those threads, and, you know, was always keeping, you know, kind of all of them in mind. And so that enabled her to see pathways from one movement to the next across her life. At the same time, you know, because of that, you're absolutely right that she, you know, she did have a very kind of episodic life. There, you know, the different chapters of the book in many ways, you know, do outline an arc of an experience with one movement and then the next and then the next. You know,
Amy, I wanted to say that I think that's probably the reason why we have not heard that much about her.
Absolutely.
Because we tend to hear about people like for instance, like a Margaret Sanger, you know, who committed to a one thing, and she was that one thing for, you know, decades. And therefore she was able to, you know, be known for that. And I think with Crystal, because she was doing so many different things, she doesn't register as strongly historically.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, that's basically the thesis of the book. You know, if there is a thesis to a biography, my understanding of her life, I absolutely agree with you, is that that is the reason that she kind of slipped through the grid or the main planks of historical memory. You know, we remember people, we understand people, and we structure narratives, whether they're historical narratives or biographical narratives. We do our research, you know, based on, you know, locating people in a particular place. And that, you know, has to do with locating them within a movement, locating them with institutions, locating them with particular mentors or particular allies or particular sets of beliefs. And, you know, Crystal did not rest with one institution or one set of allies or one set of mentors. She always was trying to bring one group into contact with the next. As a consequence, she does appear, you know, in a lot of the narratives that she appears in histories and biographies, you know, other kinds of narratives as this momentary, you know, as a glimpse, as a walk-on, as a cameo, in all of these organizations or many of them in which, you know, she had a very significant role to play. But, you know, because she was always sort of straddling more than one thing, and making connections that were sort of transgressive to, in some ways, the internal leadership structure of of an organization or of a movement, she gets pushed to the margins, or she falls out of the story, or becomes a minor player. You know, gets seen visible as a bit player, even though she may have had a very significant role actually in that organization, and in some cases actually founded the organizations and helped to lead those organizations. But she was lost to history, to the memories and the histories of those organizations, and, you know, in part because she just fell through the cracks. Many of the other women that we know today, many of the women that she worked very closely with, we know because, as you say, they, you know, they're like Alice Paul. It was associated with the National Women's Party and the suffrage movement, right? Margaret Sanger was associated with birth control and the rise of Planned Parenthood. You know, other colleagues of Crystal's, you know, were also, you know, in the peace movement, for example. We know them, we remember them because they stayed more or less in one place. They centered themselves primarily in one movement. Crystal did not do that, you know, but she really has an institutional legacy in multiple organizations, the National Women's Party and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the ACLU and the labor movement. She drafted the first series workers' compensation law. She left us an enormous institutional inheritance.
Now, but, so she's a very, what I would call a restless person, activist, because I think a lot of people feel this way, and I think she's kind of in a way comforting, because there's a lot of people who feel like, oh my gosh, there's so many issues and they're all important. And to commit to one at the exclusion of another doesn't seem to make any sense. So there are people who can see how all these things have to work together. If you're working, you know, against poverty, you also have to be working for women's rights, and you have to work for the workplace rights. And then you have, you know, there's so many things that they're all interconnected. And I think she did understand that every one of the issues of her time were interconnected, that nothing could be solved without solving the whole thing.
Yes, absolutely. And she, you know, she saw that very early on. One of the, you know, the first entries that she was a graduate of Vassar, class of 1903. And, you know, she occasionally, particularly in her early career, wrote back, you know, to her Vassar classmates. And, you know, she envisioned herself when she was in law school as she said, one of those circus ladies who, you know, is riding on a vehicle and holding aloft, you know, one set of interests in one hand and one set of interests in the other, and trying to steer this vehicle ahead, you know, in her life. And she saw those interconnections and thought that you couldn't solve one problem, as you say, without solving all of the others. And she really tried to do that in her career. But, you know, that kind of cross movement work, especially when it's consistent across a life and when it's cross movements, all of which are radical, basically, are leftist movements, are critiquing the mainstream and the status quo and the power structure, makes your life, kind of redoubles how precarious your position in society is, right? The way that you can be seen by historians and by others at the time of her life. And also kind of positions one to become a bit of a critic from within those organizations, right? That, if you talk to feminists about socialism, right, or you talk to feminists about, birth control and maternalism in a way that, the organization and the movement was, did not have in the foreground at that time, it makes your position also precarious within an organization. And within a movement. And I think that, one of the lessons, one of the interesting dilemmas and problems one of the things that's most thought-provoking about her is what she can tell us, I think, about the positions of intersectional activists today, how we, can build those bridges between movements, how we can make common cause, and how we can also understand and rethink our organizational activism to take in different points of view, and not have to either, marginalize them, or reject them in some ways in order to, in order to maintain our own coherence and our own forward momentum.
Okay. I want to move on to talk about her personal life. She married, traditional scheme. She married late. She was looking for a particular kind of marriage, which was she was redefining marriage for herself. She was redefining motherhood with her own children for herself and how a household should be run. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also, she was first married to Wallace Benedict. It didn't last long. He was an insurance salesman, I think.
Yes.
And then she married Walter Fuller, who apparently pretty much went along with her vision of how their family should be structured. So can you talk about all that whole thing there?
Sure. Yeah, that's one of my favorite topics. Crystal was innovative and experimental and brave, I think, on the front, the private life front, as much or more so even than her in her public politics. She was, more rare in her time at searching for a balance between work and family and at arguing for and trying to bring feminism into the private sphere, and not merely focus on, what it meant for women in the public, not to neglect the public. Certainly, she's been credited as a co-author of the Equal Rights Amendment. She cared about the public and equality in the public sphere, but she wanted both, and she wrote about both, and she herself experimented in ways to try to create a feminist family. Her second marriage to Walter Fuller was the one that produced her two children, and some of the most intense experimentation and the most intense dilemmas, occurred there. She always wanted children. At one point in an unpublished manuscript, she actually wrote that she wanted children even more than a public life, even more than a career. Later she, revised the piece and, brought the two into balance, that she wanted them equally. But certainly having children was always a very high priority for her, something she felt she always wanted. She wanted to be, a mother like her mother. And so she, tried a wide variety of reasons ways to take the compulsion out of the gender roles in the family, to not force her husband to be the breadwinner, but instead to share breadwinning, she was a little less successful at this, but she strongly argued for bringing men, bringing husbands, bringing fathers into the family to share housework and childcare as well. She persistently argued that male children and female children should both be raised to understand the fundamentals of housekeeping as well as the fundamentals of what it takes to have a career and to support support yourself financially, that both must learn how to do both. And that's what she tried to do, you know, in her own marriage and family, even though, you know, she was raised to it to some degree, you know, by all the sharing and experiments that her mother particularly engineered, you know, when she was growing up. You know, she certainly didn't have the kind of education and the broad-based cultural support of those ideas that she advocated for her own children and tried to create in her own household for them.
Now, the thing about that was interesting to me was that her feminist friends, her connections, were very committed and focused on political rights, and they, to them, marriage and motherhood was something. Maybe it's the best to be tolerated, but not, they had no real vision of remaking it because it's almost like it was irredeemable. But she insisted that marriage and motherhood could be remade in a feminist fashion, while her friends were like, well, we're going to work on equal rights for women. Is that, there seems to be this, she's breaking, I think, with some of more radical friends on this.
Yes, I think you're right. And certainly, you know, I write quite a bit about this in the book, that she was, you know, not alone, but she was rare in, you know, in encouraging, in advocating, in making proposals, in writing about the ways that feminism not only, you know, could or should be a part, you know, come into the family, as it were, you know, come into private life. But she said it must do so. That, you know, she felt that this was the place where most women, you know, at least when it came to motherhood, most women, she said, wanted to be mothers, wanted to have children. And she said, you know, if feminism falls to pieces at the arrival of the first baby, it is false and useless. That, you know, public rights obviously were extremely important to her. She never backed down off of that. But she also wanted, you know, a feminist understanding and a transformation of family life and of marriage, so that it would be between equals, so that men and women, you know, in families, in households, could both develop to their fullest potential, could both become themselves in the most authentic way. And she emphasized a lot in her writing that it was important, you know, to have the household become a feminist space, because that is where, you know, where gender inequality is, you know, not merely, you know, kind of exercised, but it's also born and raised. That this is where children learn what it means to be an adult, what it means to be a father, what it means to be a mother. And, you know, she wanted the kind of equal sharing and a feminist vision of the world in many ways to be able to begin and or certainly to be reproduced within the private life of the family. And she thought that since most women wanted to have children, that this was a way that feminism could touch the lives of virtually, you know, of almost all women. Not all women, you know, in her time or today, you know, really wanted to have a career or wanted to have, you know, be an activist or, you know, work in, you know, in a social change organization, like her peers, did and like she herself did. But she felt that, you know, most women wanted to have a family. And if feminism could reach them there, that was a way for feminism to rally virtually all women to the movement, all women to a new way of life, all women to the rights and opportunities that, you know, of course, she believed they deserved.
Now, she and her husband, Walter, lived and they had a two household situation for quite a long time. Can you talk about, it was transatlantic. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yeah. It was one of her, it was probably her most longstanding experiment ultimately. And she wrote a very important article in 1923 in Cosmopolitan called Marriage Under Two Roofs, in which she described the relationship and described the structural setup and the ways that, as she argued, it promoted not only equality between the partners, but a better marriage, you know, greater happiness for the partners, both because they had greater autonomy, they had greater equality, they could become themselves, they had time to themselves, as well as time that they chose to be together. But she also said it made their sex lives better. It made, you know, for a better romantic, more authentic experience of romantic love.
So, describe that for the listener. The two, they actually lived in two different places with the children. The children were mostly with her.
Yes, the children were full time with her. It was transatlantic in the sense that in the later years of her life, her husband Walter Fuller was English, and he had at one point returned after the war, had returned to England to live, and for a while she stayed in New York with the children. But eventually, you know, she found that she wanted to bring the family back together again. She didn't want to be away from her husband, and she didn't want her children to be away from their father. And so they developed, first she tried living nearby elsewhere in Europe. It was cheaper to live in Germany, for example. And so she tried to live there for a while with, you know, greater proximity to London. Once she'd had her second child, brief time allowed her to stay home for a little bit with her daughter, her second child, and not have to work and still have access to, you know, getting to London. But that didn't really pan out. It didn't really work for them after just a few months. So she came back to New York, and then almost a year later, she moved to London, but in a different household, lived in a different household than her husband. They had a rented house in Northwest London, she and the two children, and her husband lived nearby. He was a boarder. He rented a room from some mutual friends of theirs from the peace movement, who also had a family and, you know, rented out a room to Walter. They saw each other frequently, but always, as she writes about in this article, Marriage Under Two Roofs, always by choice. You know, some nights they didn't see each other at all. Sometimes they would see each other and have dinner together and have an evening together or make a plan together, and not spend the night together and, you know, separate. Other times they would decide to. And either way, she described that, you know, the choices, the lack of compulsion for both partners, made all the difference to them. On the other hand,
it was really interesting. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, on the other hand, in practice, for all the ways that it worked to improve the marriage, improve the relationship between the man and the woman, it created a lot of extra burdens on Crystal, as it basically turned her into a single parent in terms of the children. She made all the decisions in the household, you know, all the, you know, went to all the teacher meetings and handled all the homework and, you know, all the, you know, the day-to-day child rearing and child care, for both children. And that was something that she wanted. She really wanted something more like her own mother, you know, with, you know, a kind of peripheral father figure, but it took a toll on her. And she often wrote about how difficult it was to try to earn a living and also really have sole charge of the children. Her husband, Walter, contributed to the family finances on a more or less voluntary basis. That was part of the, you know, the lack of compulsion. He sometimes earned enough money to contribute, and other times did not. And so they were always in financial straits, and she was, you know, always stressed with balancing work and family all by herself.
Wow. Now she continues on with her brother to be the founder, the co-founder of the Liberator, the radical paper. And she there also finds another opportunity to create a communal living situation. Can you talk about how she's now trying to do, I think, what her mother had tried to do before? Can you talk about that? These are all experiments in how to live differently in a different way.
Yes. They're all really experiments with extended family or with families of choice. the particular communal living situation, you know, you're referring to was in Greenwich Village, when they, you know, they had a collective household where her brother, she was always trying to live with or near her brother. And, you know, he for the most part with or near her. And they, you know, it has a mixed house with some friends. They collectively paid to hire someone someone to help with the cooking and the cleaning so that they all, men and women, you know, could pursue their different careers. And, you know, kind of share a communal living space and share the burdens of maintaining a household. So it wouldn't fall on any one couple or any one person, and certainly not on the women in the group. In Greenwich Village, as it turned out, Crystal and her husband, Walter, actually ended up living up the street from that house, not in the house itself, but they joined them for meals. So they all had their, you know, their collective meals together, including her. She had a similar setup. She and Max each owned homes in Croton-on-Hudson in Westchester County in New York. And they had a kind of artist's colony there, a community also of friends, each, you know, with their own residences. And they didn't have a collective kitchen in the same way that she had growing up in Glenora, or a collective hiring of someone the way they did in Greenwich Village at the time. But they shared a lot of meals and informally, you know, collaborated on, you know, lightening everyone's burdens and also having more time to enjoy each other, more leisure time to spend together. For Crystal, one of the other families there was Margaret and her husband, Dan Lane, who had also two children. And so there was a, you know, a kind of informal collective, an informal, you know, village, if you will, to raise her children. And that, you know, was very important to her also in this period of time. When she and Max were publishing The Liberator, she already had her first child. And by the end of the Liberator years, when she and Max handed off the Liberator to other owners, she was pregnant with her second child, with her daughter. So these were early child rearing years for her, and that had a lot to do with the utility and the importance of forming these collectives everywhere she lived. You know, it takes a village to raise a child, and she tried to create those villages around her in order to do that, and still, you know, maintain her work at the Liberator, maintain her career.
Okay, so I have a final question for you: is what does Crystal Eastman offer the contemporary reader? What's the takeaway? What did we get from her?
Boy, so much. I personally have gotten so much, you know, from my relationship with her and from learning about her and thinking about her ideas and listening to her. You know, she provides the, you know, kind of some very contemporary ideas and on issues that are still pressing and still, you know, up for debate, very much up for debate today. You know, she talked about and advocated for, you know, reproductive rights and for, you know, wages for wives and for work-family balance and for the Equal Rights Amendment and, you know, for, you know, different kinds of education to promote equality between men and women, for different kinds of laws to promote and reinforce equality between men and women, for paid parental leave, like a whole range of issues that still, more than a century later, are on our activist agenda, are on our public agenda. And so she, you know, she provides a lot of insight, not only into the history of those movements and those ideas, and some kind of roads not taken in pursuing them, but also, you know, gives us a sense of the greater, I think, urgency that, you know, after all this time, you know, we must finally, you know, cross the bridge. We must finally achieve some of those things. I think she also gives us a lot to think about in terms of the intersectional questions. You know, how we deal with differences amongst our allies. You know, how do we come together around common cause? Some of the reasons that I think Crystal Eastman has been lost or obscured to historical memory, create a mandate for us to think about, you know, going forward, you know, how we're going to do a better job of understanding our differences, of confronting them, of, you know, embracing them, of working with them, of really forming authentic bonds among allies so that we can move forward strongly and together to achieve progressive goals. And it seems to me that, you know, particularly these days, you know, both of those lessons, both of those kind of sets of questions and ideas that she gives us, you know, couldn't be more relevant. It's as though we, you know, we we just need her so much right now, in my view. And she has an awful lot. She always had a lot to say, and she gives us so much to think about, sort of in both of those ways, both our activist ways and our the ways that our movements move forward, and the ideas, the agenda that we have.
Well, thank you, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.